another brilliant sunny day. It is hot, and we are going to talk about gardening. Who in their right mind would be out in the garden today? Nobody. That's why you're inside listening to the Mary Griffith Show. Kathy Carpenter is here. She is our master gardener from the University of Illinois Extension, and she better than anyone knows that there's probably nothing that absolutely needs to be done today that you can't put off until another day in the garden. Is that correct?
I'm an expert at that. Believe me, I am.
How have the recent rains? Now, I mean, it's been about a week, but we really got some torrential downpours there and also some slow, steady rains. Mm-hmm. I think that saved the farmers. I think it might have saved our corn crop, for one thing. But how did that do for lawns, bushes, shrubs, flowers, vegetables?
Hey, plants welcome rain whenever it comes. And I've noticed just anecdotally that my yard is a lot greener with less watering this year than it has been in some recent years. So I think every little bit helps. And it's been very sporadic in terms of amounts. Last couple days I got about a half inch mm-hmm. of rain, but I have people that have come up to me and said they've had like 2 inches of rain. So
even though we're still in drought, even though we're technically rain deficient, it's when it comes mm-hmm. and how easily it seeps into the ground. Because sometimes if you get a torrential rain, it runs off.
Mm-hmm.
So a good soak overnight, even if we're still deficient. The drought is not broken by any legal stretch of the imagination.
Right,
There's a definition for drought, and we are in it. But it looks like we're doing okay.
Every little bit helps, let's put it that way. And, yes, there's going to be heat stress now that everything's going up. But the humidity, in a sense, while it's awful for us, it can sort of help the plants because they don't transpire as much. So they don't lose as much water out of their leaves.
Because it's so water vaporous around them.
Exactly.
It's a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. Well, today we are open to any questions you have. And, folks, this is a service from the University of Illinois Master Gardeners Program. Kathy Carpenter spends a lot of time preparing for these things. We're talking a little bit about pest control today, I know. But we want your phone calls, 223-9300, 223-9300, 1-800-228-WTAD, 1-800-228-9823. Do not delay. Call right now, and we'll get right to it. My personal question first. I have all of these daylilies.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've got like 6 daylily plants. One of them is just blooming out of control. The others have just 1 or 2 blooms. I'm watering them. I don't understand. Why is one doing so much better?
Well, a lot of times it's the bloom period. You know, you have daylilies that are that bloom in early June. You have daylilies that bloom kind of June, July, and then you have daylilies that bloom in mid to late July. There are a few ever blooming daylilies, but personally, I don't think they're as showy as some of the others. So it could just be that. Could be that you have, like I do, a wandering deer, which seems to be able to nip off those buds just before they become a flower.
Yes, we have that problem.
I have on both sides of my mailbox, I've got daylilies. One side, the deer found. The other side, they didn't. So I have beautiful flowers on one side and a few scrawny ones on the other.
That makes sense, because the ones that are close to my house are the ones that are getting eaten off. And that's when I back out of the garage. I see the doe there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones by the street where, you know, they would be more skittish, those are the ones that are flowering big time. Well, we've got a caller. Enough about my daylily problems. We've got to get to some real problems from some real WTAD listeners. Our first caller is on the line. Good morning. What is your question for Master Gardener Kathy Carpenter?
Good morning. I have a daylily problem also, and I don't know if you had talked about that prior. I turned my radio down. What makes the bottom leaves turn brown? What am I doing something or not doing something?
Well, it's hard to say. Yes, like any plant, you have leaves that get mature and die off. However, there is something called daylily rust, which can affect daylilies. Mm. And in a sense, that could be part of the problem. But if it's just a few leaves at the bottom, I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Okay, if it seems just look a little shabby is what, you know what I mean?
Oh, sure, sure. But, you know, gardens aren't perfect and neither are plants. And sometimes they just don't look as good as we, the gardener, would like to see them.
I think mm-hmm. I might have this, daylily mm-hmm. rust, because I've got a little of that. So what?
Well, first, let's see if it is. You know, take a Kleenex or something.
Okay.
And run it along that leaf.
The dead one.
The dead or the brownish-looking one. And then, particularly on the underside of the leaf, mm-hmm. and then look at it and mm-hmm. see if it looks like there's a lot of, minuscule dry stuff. I mean, not pieces of the leaf, but stuff that you, like dust that you
like
would wipe
skin.
Off. Yes.
Like dry, flaky skin.
And you know, if it looks a little on the reddish-brown side, and there's a fair amount of it, you know, that may be what it is.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news is there's not a whole lot you can do about daylily rust other than, yes, remove the leaf, get it out of contact, because it will spread by its little spores. It's basically mm-hmm. a fungal disease. And try to see and keep your daylilies nourished well and watered.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just wondered if it meant that they were getting sort of thick and I needed to, you know,
not
them
necessarily.
Out or that doesn't have anything to do with it. Huh?
Well, not necessarily. Although,
okay.
like any plant that's a perennial, daylilies do have to be divided. And they have to be divided probably about every 3 years when they begin to look like they're really getting close together and mm-hmm. jammed up. And that just means you have more daylilies to spread around your yard.
Right.
But it's a bear and a half to do them because mm-hmm. they have interlocking roots. Once you dig up the clump, you have to pry them apart, usually mm-hmm. using two of the gardening forks.
Mm-hmm.
And just
I'll try that.
In the fall when they're a lot less likely to be stressed.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was a great first call. The second caller is on the line.
Okay.
Good morning. What is your question for our master gardener?
Well, I've noticed this year I have a lot of phlox plants in my yard and blooming beautifully right now. Mm-hmm. And all the years I've had them, I've always had butterflies and bees always all around busy. Well, this year I hardly ever see a butterfly or a bee, and
mm-hmm.
it worries me.
Well, now you're talking, you have the showy garden phlox, I'm assuming, you know, the kind of bigger flowered
ones. Big, tall, kind of wild-like.
Oh, I see. Well, the first question I'd ask is, are you using pesticides on your yard?
No.
No, good. That's
My
that's
neighbor a, is, but that I don't think comes over where my phlox is.
Okay, because that still could be part of it, because you know, the butterflies and bees, they don't know, you know, one plant from another, and they don't know what's been used on those plants, especially if it was what they call a systemic insecticide. In other words, one that is taken up by the plant, and it basically turns the whole plant into poison city. And so even if a butterfly or a bee comes to get the nectar from the nectar is poisonous to them. So if a lot of people in your neighborhood have been using insecticides and they're fairly close to you, that might be part of it because the insects are being poisoned even before they get to your plants, which are not poisonous to them.
Well, one side they put poison, and the other side where I have a lot of the blocks, they don't put any.
Mm-hmm. That's true, but what I'm saying is it's a neighborhood and there's plants and insects are in a delicate relationship, and if they go first to your neighbors that uses the insecticide, they get poisoned, you're not going to see them in your yard very much. So that could be part of it. The other thing is that we have an issue in this day and age with insects being poisoned generally throughout their population. So what happens is it reduces the general population of your beneficial insects and your beautiful insects like the butterflies, and there are fewer of them to find mates and fewer places where they can lay their eggs and, you know, have their larvae. And so the populations will generally tend to go down. People are getting more educated on this, but unfortunately, people seem to think that gardens should be absolutely picture perfect. And to that end, they want to make sure they don't have any holes in their leaves or anything like that. And they spray, unfortunately. They don't realize that the spray has a lot more impact.
Yeah,
generally.
Our food.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like? 60-70% of our food depends
on pollinating insects,
yeah.
And that's very true. And people are getting wiser. The farmers are even getting wiser on this. But still, there's still too much indiscriminate pesticide usage in our country.
Yeah, I look out and I see nothing.
You have deserts.
And I just think, is anybody else noticing this?
Well,
this same situation with my yard has been that way for years and years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the people on the north of me have been putting that stuff out for 30 years and still had butterflies and stuff. So
yeah.
I don't understand it exactly, but
it's a bigger problem than just one yard. Let's put it that way.
It's a bigger problem than your yard, and the population is diminishing. So we're going to talk about pest management in a moment and ways that you can do pest management that's not harmful to other things.
Yeah,
so,
I think we should be thinking about it.
Okay, well, thank
Definitely.
You for your phone call.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
You have a great day. Somebody who cares about our environment. Boy, the phone lines are lit now. Let's see where we can go next. Thank you for waiting. You're on The Mary Griffith Show with Master Gardener Kathy Carpenter. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay. I have a hydrangea bush, and it's not blooming. Last year it bloomed, but this year it's not.
Okay. Hydrangeas can be kind of tricky. There could be a number of reasons why the hydrangea isn't blooming very well. The big leaf hydrangea, the snowball kind of hydrangea types, don't like to be in a lot of shade. If it's getting more shade than it should, for whatever reason, it may not bloom as well.
It's in the sunlight.
Okay. Now, next thing is, if they're around an area where you spread lawn fertilizer, a lot of times the hydrangea will take up too much nitrogen, which stimulates leaf growth, not blooms. And sometimes a hydrangea that's gotten too much fertilizer meant maybe for a lawn or too high in nitrogen is not going to bloom as well, if at all. That's another reason that the hydrangea might not bloom. And then the third reason that a hydrangea may not bloom is let me see now. I'm blanking. Hydrangea is sensitive to cold in the winter, and if it's in a position where it got its incipient flower buds that appear on new wood gets frozen out, they will not bloom for you either because the flower buds have been kind of blasted by the cold.
Okay, so there's three reasons it might be. So I guess you can hope for next year and have a little better result, okay?
Okay, then. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Oh, boy, Kathy Carpenter knows her stuff. We're going to take a quick break. Our phone lines are open, 223-9300, 1-800-228-9823, 1-800-228-WTAD. Dial now so you can be guaranteed to get in. Third Thursday of the month, The Mary Griffith Show presents the Master Gardener program. Our Master Gardener is Kathy Carpenter. And so your phone calls are welcome. What questions do you have about your garden, your lawn, your trees? We're going to talk a little bit about pest management, too. 223-9300, 1-800-228-9823. The phone lines are open now. Kathy, we've talked a little bit about pest management, mm-hmm. ways that maybe aren't appropriate to take care of pests because they kill everything else.
Right.
So let's talk about pest management.
Well, integrated pest management is a phrase that's been used at the university for, I would say, as long as I've been a master gardener anyway. And what it means is exactly that, integrated. You don't rely on one thing to get rid of pests. And pests can be insects, pests can be diseases, pests can be, fungal,
deer,
all kinds of pests. So the first thing you do is you have to be sure to have healthy plants, because a healthy plant is one that's going to be naturally more resistant to attacks and less, one that when they don't seek out. The pests seek the weak plants. So you want to keep them healthy to begin with. In other words, you want to have the right plant in the right place. You want to give them enough food, enough water, and keep the weeds down. Weeds are pests, too, because they take nutrients and stuff from the plant and make them more susceptible to attack by other things. So the first thing you do then, in addition, of course, to right plant, right place, healthy plants. You don't want to plant plants that are going to be sick to begin with. You want to monitor your garden. And by monitoring, it can be as simple as walking around and looking. You know, there'll always be a certain number of insects around that are kind of getting into your plants. But
that's almost a good thing.
Yes.
I mean, you don't want a sterile, completely sterile environment.
Exactly so. You want the pollinators to come in. You want the good predator insects to prey on the bad insects that are munching your plants. So you want to take a look at it. You want to take a look at your plants. You want to see, do they look healthy to begin with? You want to take a look at what's on your plants. Nature isn't perfect, and you can't expect to have a plant that never has any holes in it or never does it, and never has a little brown leaf or brown spots or anything like that. But what you want to do is make sure that the plant is winning the battle against the things that might attack it. So if you go into your garden and you find a plant that is absolutely, you know, has most of its leaves munched or a good majority of its leaf munched or even a third of its leaves munched, you want to try to find out what's doing this, you know, and look at the plant. Look on the underside of the leaves. Look on the tops of the leaves. Look around. See what might possibly be causing the damage.
Should we catch it and, like, bring it in the house and Google it? I mean,
yeah.
Today we have that technology.
You have to identify the enemy is right. What you have to do and find out what the best way is of dealing with it. For example, my tomato plants, I was out in my vegetable garden, which looks pathetic, by the way, even though I'm presumably a master gardener. And I saw some big old fat tomato hornworms on my tomato plants. Well, I looked at those hornworms. They didn't have any parasitic wasp eggs on their back, which you sometimes see. So I said, got to get rid of these guys. So I plucked them off and got rid of them that way, physically. That way, I'm not poisoning the entire ecosystem, and I've gotten rid of the thing that was munching on my tomato plants. If they'd had those little eggs on there, I would have said, you just go ahead and eat as much as you want, because those insects are going to eat you when they hatch into larvae inside you and eat you from the inside out.
Ooh.
And then they will become more little parasitic wasps to go onto more tomato hornworms. So that's no problem. Sometimes you can get the critters that are eating the bad guys and encourage them that way. The other thing is that, you know, things like cultural management, not just monitoring and looking you have to monitor and then you have to make a decision whether you have to intervene or not intervene, vice versa. Cultural management is what we do when we're pulling weeds and we're hoeing and we're keeping the weeds down. We take away debris that might prove to be good hiding places for the bad guys in under there. And so you maintain the conditions that promote healthy plants. Mulching is a good thing to some extent, but if you mulch too much, it can provide a cover for rodents that might come in and eat your plants, or overwintering places for the bad insects as well. So keep your garden reasonably clean, reasonably weed-free, and that also, that, and of course, sufficient things like enough water, enough food for your plants, that sort of thing. That's cultural management. All these things don't involve putting poisons on your soil. But then there's also physical management, ways to block the bad guys from getting on your plants. For example, I plant cucumbers, or at least I did before the heat wave. At any rate, the cucumbers can be attacked by a beetle, which munches them and transmits a bacteria to them, which causes cucumber wilt, which means no cucumbers. So what I do with my cucumbers generally is I take one of those row covers, those light, airy-looking cloth-like things that you can cover your plants with, and I put them on until the cucumber plants are big enough and have started to flower, because unfortunately, cucumbers are insect-pollinated. So if you kept the row covers on the whole time, you wouldn't get any cucumbers. So at one point, but when they're big enough and strong enough, I take the row cover off once those flowers come out, and that way I have very little issue with cucumber wilt in my garden. That's one example of a cultural practice. Another thing is like you put a tiny baby little tomato plant out in your garden, and you come out the next day and a cutworm has just bitten that thing right off at the roots. Empty a can, an old vegetable can. Plop the can around it until it gets big enough that the cutworms aren't interested anymore.
So it's like hollow out a can almost, take the bottom
exactly.
off and the
top, and the
top off, and plant your plant, and then put that down around it as a barrier. It will not cut into the roots because it hasn't started growing yet, so
yeah.
But it will. The cutworm comes along and ding, ding, ding.
Because the cutworm is on the surface, and the cutworm has to get in access to the stem. And if it can't get the stem, you can't eat your plant.
Take that, you nasty little cutworm.
Exactly, exactly. And then, you know, it's true that you can also physically manage insects, like you got lots of aphids on a plant. Sharp spray of water on that plant can knock all those aphids off. And you don't have to spray them. You've reduced the population sucking the juices out of your plant to a level where your plant isn't going to be bothered by them anymore. But to just reflexively hit the pesticides, you are probably killing more beneficials than you are killing the bad guys. And in some cases, if you're using what they call a systemic, where the poison actually goes up into the plant, you could be killing beneficials that drink the nectar or eat the pollen from that plant, because
right.
it's equally poisonous. So,
and you'd be surprised how integrated root systems are. Just think how your tree branches out. If you've got mm-hmm. a big tree in your yard, the drip line of that tree, if you're treating something over near the drip line, could be poisoning the root of that tree when you're only trying to kill just a weed or something in your
right.
in your garden patch.
Right.
So you
exactly.
have to use some caution.
The only time that I've actually used, you know, a pesticide.
Like seven is a pesticide.
Is if it was clear to me from looking at the plant that the plant will die if I didn't get those insects out now. And that's happened very rarely. I had an attack of flea beetles on a plant once, and I sprayed it. But it was one plant, one discrete location, and the plant lived. there's other chemical kinds of biological kinds of management.
Why can't you put down something that deters, like, raccoons and deer won't come near wolf urine or whatever, you know? So grab
Except
your
they get used to anything.
Grab a friendly wolf and have it pee in a cup for you,
yeah,
and
well,
you don't
actually,
have to worry.
There are
yeah.
people who have figured that out. And
yeah.
You can buy it as a
yes.
And yes, that will work temporarily. But any animal will get used to a scent if it's around
and
most
they'll know
of the
that
time.
There's not a wolf around, even though they smell a wolf, they'll figure out, hey,
I'm okay.
I think I'm okay.
Exactly. So what you have to do is maybe for several weeks use the wolf urine and then maybe switch to fox urine or maybe switch to, I've heard gardeners swear by Irish Spring soap, hanging it on, you know, like trees and such where the plants were browsed by deer. But, you know, again, they'll get used to anything, and if they're hungry enough, they will eat anything, even stuff they normally don't eat or don't like.
Look for plants
that the deer don't like. I mean, there's enough other things around. They'll eat that, and they'll leave your plants alone.
I think the Irish Spring got started because people realized how nasty that smelled on their body. And they had a whole bunch of extra cakes of it. And so they said, if it's this nasty, let's put it out in the trees.
Yeah,
and
some
we'll
people
see what
hang,
happens.
Visit their friendly local hairdresser and collect hair.
Yes.
And hang the hair in bags around. And mm-hmm. it works for a while. But again, you have to trade off different
scents.
Got to
get different hair.
Exactly. Got to
get different hair from different people. Redheaded
right.
hair may not do the same as blonde or brunette. Yeah. So rotate your hair crop.
Yeah, good. and as far as the smaller rodents, a nice outdoor farm type cat can do wonders in reducing chipmunk populations and vole populations mm-hmm. and that sort of thing.
Well, we got to take a break, but our woodchuck is back. My husband, well, it's not the same woodchuck. I'm sure it's probably son of woodchuck. My husband was always telling me about this wonderful woodchuck that lived kind of in our backyard down by the creek. And this woodchuck was not afraid of anything. And so my husband would actually come out and mow the lawn before we were married, before I even knew him. And the woodchuck would just lay there on its back with its paws sticking out. And my husband would have to mow around this woodchuck because the woodchuck wasn't afraid of anything. Well, we got married. I moved in. Woodchuck went away. But I saw son of woodchuck the other day. And he is enormous. So
yeah.
We put a saddle on him and ride him around. I think I'm going to enter him in the county fair. It's 10 minutes away from Fox News at the top of the hour, and you've got a chance to get your phone calls and your questions answered. 223-9300, 1-800-228-WTAD. Dial now. If you're not in by the time the commercial break ends, you're not going to make it. Today on the Mary Griffith Show with Master Gardener Kathy Carpenter. We're back, Talk Radio 930 WTAD. A caller has a question for Kathy Carpenter, our Master Gardener. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My question is, I have four knockout roses, and they are doing terrible this year. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what do you think the problem is?
Well, when you say they're doing terrible, what terrible is it to
well,
you?
Well, they're not blooming,
mm-hmm.
and they're not even growing, you know, how they usually grow out,
uh-huh.
just dying off.
I see.
And they're not in the same area. Some's in the front, two are in the front, and two are in the back.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of symptoms, I mean, you're saying they haven't bloomed, really. Are the leaves looking diseased? Are they dropping off? Do they look strange?
Well, they have holes at them, and so I sprayed with 7. I didn't know if you should do that or not.
Well, did you see what was making the holes?
No.
Yeah, because sometimes the holes could be from where there are some an insect called a leaf cutter bee, which is pretty beneficial insect and can make holes, mostly though on the outside edges of the leaves. They look like somebody's taken a little crescent-shaped bite out of them. That's a leaf cutter bee. But the holes in the center, yes, it probably was some kind of insect munching, but again, you don't know for sure if it's not there. You're not really killing too much with a contact insecticide, you know, like 7, although it might linger a bit on the leaf and poison the few insects that come to try to munch. I have one knockout rose that probably meets the same description as your knockout rose. I've had it in the garden a fair amount of time, and it could be just kind of reaching the end of its lifespan, because I have two other knockout roses that look fine. How long have you had these roses?
About 2 years.
Oh, then that's not the answer there either.
Did you fertilize them too much and put too much nitrogen on so that they're not blooming? Is that a problem?
No, yeah. I don't put nitrogen on.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You just use rose food formulated for roses, or just don't feed them?
I don't fertilize. I just put them in the garden, and it's like a flower mm-hmm. garden.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. You might try, number one, prune them back a little bit. You know, take out the stuff that looks the worst. Then give them a little food and make sure that they stay nicely watered during, especially this is a very stressful time for any plant, roses included. You might find that they'll perk up for you when things begin to get cooler. But that's probably your best bet right now. There are some diseases that can attack roses, but I'd hesitate to blame disease first. I'd look at the conditions. They don't like heat either.
Well, we're out of time. I hope your knockout roses live. Only 2 years old. Maybe they just need a good fertilizing and a good dose of water. We'll hope that solves the problem.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much, Kathy Carpenter.
My pleasure.